call the case.
Case number SCWC28592, Hawaii Association of Seventh-day Adventists versus Guam. Arguing for petitioner, Michael Tom. Arguing for respondent, Mark Valencia. Also appearing for the respondent, Michael Marsh. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. Are you both ready to proceed? All right. My understanding, Mr. Tom, you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, so we'll have a warning light that comes on and lets you know when you've reached that point in your argument. And Mr. Valencia, you'll have a warning light with 5 minutes to go. Is that correct? Very well. Now, please proceed, Mr. Tom.
May it please the court. As the court is aware, this dispute has a long and tortured history, and the litigation that has arisen from it has been protracted and expensive. What I'd like to do is to share with the court what I believe are the salient facts that the court needs to take into consideration when ultimately reaching the issues on appeal that are certified to the court. And I'd like to start with a discussion of the complaint, what brought us to this point, and then a discussion of the development of the relationship between the parties and the nature of the dispute and how it evolved into the lawsuit. The property is located in Kaloa on Kauai. It's located mauka of the main highway from Lihue to Barking Sands, and it is used as a school by the Seventh-day Adventists. I don't think there's any dispute about that use. The dispute arises from the use of cabins that are located on the property that were put there by the prior lessee of the property, a company called Kahili Mountain Park, Inc., which was a company owned by some of the beneficiaries of the Eric A. Knudsen Trust, of which Mr. Wong, the petitioner, is the current trustee. The interest in the land occurred when the school, in a school on Kauai, was looking to relocate, and they ultimately settled upon the Kahili Mountain Park area. And they approached the then lessee of the property, Kahili Mountain Park, Inc., and entered into a deposit receipt offering acceptance to purchase the leasehold interest. The conditions of the DROA required that the association, the church, be able to obtain the necessary permits so that a school could be used in what is essentially agricultural land. And so, as part of the process leading up to the new lease, the association submitted to the county a request for a special use permit and a Class 4 zoning permit. And in that application, which is part of the record, they advised the county planning commission that the cabins that had been there would be used only for church members.
But wouldn't we be looking at the actual terms of the agreement? This is now parole evidence you're talking about, is that correct?
This is to put it in context.
Okay.
Yes. So we then get to the lease, which is entered into between the parties on December 31, 1984. And almost from the outset, there is a dispute over whether or not the lease allows the association to rent the cabins to the public. There has never been a dispute that they can use it for the uses enumerated within paragraph 16 of the lease. To get to the heart of the matter, the interpretation of the lease is interpreted as if it were a contract. And if we're not using parole evidence.
Are you arguing for, that's where I'm very confused. Are you arguing that we should or should not consider the parole evidence? Because it seems like both sides are arguing that the lease terms are clear, although both sides are saying the interpretations are totally different, and that you don't need to consider parole evidence. However, you did present a lot of parole evidence.
I did. Two issues before the court. The first is the interpretation of the lease. And we submit that parole evidence is not required. If there is a determination that the use of the cabins, renting them to the public, is a violation of the lease, as we say it is, then you need to look at whether it is appropriate to terminate the lease. And in looking at that issue, you have to determine whether or not the breach was willful, persistent, intentional. And as a consequence, that's the reason all the information about the internal discussions within the association regarding the use of the lease land and the rental of cabins becomes germane.
Is there any dispute that there was not a cure within the 30 days provided for under the lease?
There is. If you look at the record, and I can give the citations to the Record on Appeal, Mr. Wong becomes the trustee in 2000, I believe it is. There are discussions with the Adventists starting as early as 2001. There is an April 11 letter that is quoted by the ICA in its memorandum opinion, in which Mr. Wong advises the president of the association that they are in material breach of the lease. He cites paragraph 16, and he also quotes the defeasance paragraph 19, which is, I think, the heart of the trust and justice. Between April 11, and as an aside, Mr. Wong shared a draft of that letter with Mr. Trujillo on April 4. And if the court takes a look at the record, you will see a draft of that letter. It's an SDA document, and I can provide the court with a citation to the Record on Appeal. The words, material default, is circled or is highlighted, and there's a notation, check out material default. Mr. Wong's draft of April 4 also addresses the remedies that are available for this willful, persistent breach, and that is termination. Nothing happens. There is no cessation of the rental of cabins until sometime in 2002, over a year later. So we don't disagree that after the March letter in 2002 was sent, that the association ceased the rental. But the history of the use of this property by the association has been of continually questioning whether they have a right to do what they're doing, reaching the conclusion that they're in violation of the lease, that they're in violation not only of the specific terms of the lease, but violate their core principles that make them what they are.
Mr. Tom, I have a more fundamental question in terms of the law. Would you agree that whether or not the paragraph is ambiguous is a question of law?
I believe it is a question of law for the judge to determine as a matter of first instance, yes.
And therefore, whether or not parole evidence should or should not be considered in construing such an ambiguous, if the court finds that it is ambiguous, it would be a question of law as to whether or not parole evidence should be considered in construing that clause.
I think that's correct also, Justice.
Thank you. Please proceed.
But I need to stress the purpose for parading the litany of the internal machinations of the association, where they all concluded we need to stop violating the lease, deals not with the interpretation of the lease. It deals with the nature of the breach. The state of mind, the collective state of mind of the association in recognizing what their obligations are under the lease and saying, we need the money. I mean, that in essence, I think, is what happened.
Mr. Tom, prior, did the predecessor to the association rent these cabins out to the public?
They did. They had a separate lease that recognized that there would be rental of cabins to the public. And that separate lease, and it's in the record, required the prior lessee, Kahili Mountain Park Inc., to pay percentage rent based upon the gross revenues received from the rentals of those cabins. So that's the dichotomy. You have a commercial operation recognized within the particular lease document, and there's payment of percentage rent in addition to the minimum rent. You have the lease between the Adventist and the trust, which does not address it, at least certainly cabin rentals, and as a consequence.
But if you look at section or paragraph 16, the first sentence says demised premises shall be used only for educational recreation, parentheses, including vacation residence for members and staff of lessee school and church, close parentheses, agricultural, healthcare, and humanitarian uses. Is there any qualification on the uses there as to whether or not it is limited only to church or members of the church and cannot be used by the public?
Yeah. Two responses, Justice. First, if you look at the sentence you just read, there is a word of restriction within that first sentence, and that word is only. So the demise premises shall be used only, and then the critical term is recreation, and then the parenthetical.
But you're making including mean something completely different than what most people think the word including means.
No, I think it all it does is modify the term recreation and defines what that term means. It's allowing vacation rental for members and staff of the lessee school. It does not say you can rent to the general public. And if I may, the second part of my answer is in construing the obligations under the lease, I think the court needs to look at the lease as a whole. We have been focusing upon paragraph 16. Paragraph 1.1b, remember this is a 60-year lease. There are step-ups in the rents that are paid, and the lease in paragraph 1b talks about what happens upon the expiration of the 30th year, and there is a formula for calculating what that lease rent will be. And let me just read part of it. You multiply the prevailing rate of return, etc., by the then fair market value of the land, then demised by this lease, as if unencumbered by this lease. And here's the critical language. But restricted in use, as in this lease, restricted. So when you couple 1B with 16, you have to read paragraph 16 restrictively. There is the 1B language, there is the rules of the paragraph 16 language, and again, going back to paragraph 16, you have the
restricted uses would be limiting it for education, recreation, etc., healthcare, humanitarian uses.
That's correct.
And so that doesn't indicate, though, who can be involved in that use, does it?
It does not say that you can rent this to the general public. And if you look at the second sentence of paragraph 16, again, there's language of restriction. It says no dwellings shall be used on the demise premises, except for faculty, administrative staff, students, and employees. Doesn't say anything about the general public.
You just mentioned that redetermination provision. Doesn't that redetermination provision also say that when you're determining the annual rent, it'll be equal to property that is similar to the type of property that's under covered by this?
Yes, and that there are consequences to that. If the court does not reverse the memorandum opinion, that the grant of summary judgment in favor of the trust is affirmed, and we return to the circuit court, and the circuit court determines that what the association is saying is true, then when we redetermine the rent at the end of 2014, it will be a use that allows vacation rentals to the public. It's going to be a whole different series of comparable properties that will be looked at. You're going
to
be looking
at that's to your advantage.
We don't believe that that was the intent. I understand the consequences, Justice, but we believe that the purpose of this lease was to assist the association in the operation of its school, not the town of Memphis.
Okay, but you're trying to say that the public is restricted, and every other use, when it's talking about church and school, we're talking about public.
We're talking about tenements. If the church wanted to have a wellness center.
How is agricultural, health care, humanitarian uses, educational uses restricted? How is that restricted it applies to the public for certain.
If the particular use was humanitarian, so that they were having wellness seminars, or they were having seminars regarding the function of the church, there would be no reservation that they could use that for those purposes. It is the rental of the cabins that are there to the public that is of concern to the trust.
Mr. Tom, are you also arguing that the lack of a percentage rent type of clause in this lease indicates an intent to not allow commercial types of enterprises?
Yes. And that is sort of the second point on appeal. If we get past the issue of the interpretation of the lease and we're dealing with termination, and if court determines that we should not be terminating this lease because equity abhors a forfeiture.
If we were to apply the rule of statutory construction that says including means expansive rather than limiting, that would work against your client's interest.
I don't believe so within the context of the interpretation of this lease. The case that is cited by the association, the Woodward-Clyde case, dealt with an interpretation of the wrongful death statute and was defining who would fall within the class of people enumerated within the statute. That's a matter of statutory construction. What the court is charged to do in interpreting a lease between the parties is to ultimately reach the intention of the parties. So yes, the absence of a percentage rent provision speaks wonders as to the intent of the party.
So if there is any ambiguity, okay, patent or latent, is it not the law of this jurisdiction that parallel evidence is to be considered to try to ascertain the intent of the parties?
If it is ambiguous, then yes, parallel evidence should be considered. But we do not believe that Judge Watanabe felt that it was ambiguous. We have always contended that the provision is not ambiguous, and therefore it should be read based on the four corners.
Did she rely at all? Well, she didn't issue findings. So do we know whether or not she actually relied at all on the parallel evidence that you did submit?
In her oral ruling, and again, this is part of the record, I believe she says, I did not rely on parallel evidence. Again, maybe a fine point, but a point that is worth repeating. We did not submit the information regarding all of the internal discussions within the church for the purposes of interpreting the lease. What we were providing that to Judge Watanabe before was for the determination of whether, if she found that there was a material breach, whether the lease should be terminated. I think if you just read through all of the discussions and the deposition testimony of the members of the association, they knew they were violating the lease, yet did nothing to stop it. There was even a vote to stop the ranking of Kevin. That was ignored.
How about your client? Did your client, there's an argument that there's a estoppel or waiver or an oral agreement that the trustee was aware of all this for many, many years, and that would preclude the recovery of damages. So could you speak to that issue?
Sure.
Is there a question of material fact on that issue? Would you agree?
Well, we obtained summary judgment on count three of the complaint, which is specifically the waiver of estoppel provision.
You can finish. You can respond.
Let me finish this. There is an express non-waiver provision within the lease. It's paragraph 19. And I think the record is also clear that almost from the time that this lease was entered into, one of the beneficiaries, Eric Elkmanson, was complaining about the fact that cabins were being rented. So I don't think that there's a waiver. And as I said, Justice, we have summary judgment on that particular comment.
How do you respond to the ICA, which says that in the first sentence allows a use to church members, and then the second sentence takes it away?
I don't agree that it allows use. I don't agree that it allows the rental of the cabins to the public.
But they're talking church members.
Right.
The first sentence says, including use of vacation rentals for church members. So that's specifically allowed in that sentence. And the second sentence seems to take it away under your interpretation.
No. The uses that are enumerated in the first sentence can still be accomplished. The church members can still do everything within that first sentence. The only thing that is prohibited is you cannot use a dwelling that is not used for those purposes. So I don't see the inconsistency.
So is it your interpretation that dwelling includes vacation rent?
Yes.
Then why do you need the parenthetical in the first sentence at all? Because the second sentence would explicitly allow it. You're making the first sentence parenthetical meaningless.
No, I think it's the other way around. I think interpreting the parenthetical to allow rentals to third parties is expansive, and we believe that paragraph 16 should be read restrictively.
Let me see if I can clarify maybe. Dwellings include, under your definition, both vacation rentals and other types of places to live in. So if there's an exception, it says no dwellings shall be constructed except for faculty. That means faculty, administrative staff, students, and employees can use it any way they wish, including for vacation.
No, I think you have to reconcile the two sentences. You can't segregate them. They have to be read in context. The uses that the dwellings can be put to are for educational, recreation, agricultural, healthcare, and humanitarian purposes, not rental to third parties.
Okay. Mr. Valencia?
Please support. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices. I'd just like to acknowledge that the President of the Church, Mr. Ralph Watts, and the Treasurer, Mr. Verdun, this morning.
Good morning.
The primary legal issue, as this Court knows, is the interpretation of the lease and whether the word, I think, including is one of expansion or limitation. But at its core, this case is about the education of children. That's why the church in 1982 purchased Pahiwi Mountain Park, an existing cabin rental operation. They purchased it with the intention of using income to support a K-12 school. That's why in 1984, they signed a 60-year lease and relocated the K-12 school to Kahili Mountain Park. And
is the school still operating?
Yes, Your Honor. They relocated the school, invested approximately $1 million in capital improvements in this property.
And Mr. Valencia, if this lease was made to the association, would it be reasonable to assume that the use would all be limited to church use or use by members of the church and not open generally to the public?
Justice Acoba, I think that would be a correct assumption if there was language in the lease that restricted it just to church members.
Okay. So in section 16, the first sentence contains no restriction. Contains no restriction as to who can participate in this, in these uses.
Justice Acoba, there is a restriction. And I think if you have to, I think you have to read.
I'm only reading the first sentence.
The first sentence. There is a restriction on the kinds of uses, but not who can use. In that
I thought if I didn't state it that way, then I was wrong. But that's exactly what I'm saying.
Yes.
So why does the opposing party then come up with the construction that this must be in some way related to the church and cannot be used by the public generally?
I think if you kind of step back and look at the individual that Mr. Tom mentioned near the close of his argument, Eric L. Knutson, one of the Knutson beneficiaries, he is sort of the person who started this dispute. And Mr. Tom indicated that from the outset there was a dispute. I think that is incorrect. I don't believe the record supports that statement. But years after the lease was signed, Mr. Eric L. Knutson got a hold of the lease. He used to manage the park, Mr. Eric L. Knutson. So he got a hold of the lease and read it and indicated and concluded that the church should be charged percentage rent. And there was no percentage rent provision in the lease. So Mr. Eric L. Knutson went to church members and started to tell them that they were cheating the family. He went to members of the school and said this to them. That's the genesis of all this parole evidence that has formed the heart of Mr. Wong's appeal. But that's where it started. And I think it's important to note, too, that despite Mr. Eric L. Knutson's allegation that the church was cheating the family, First Hawaiian Bank was the trustee, 1986 to 2000. And they never questioned the church's use of the property. And they knew what the church was doing. This wasn't some secret operation over at Kahina Mountain Park. Alan Zataki, who was the First Hawaiian Bank representative, was deposed and acknowledged that it didn't surprise him that the church had a cabin rental operation. So if you're asking, Justice, where they get their interpretation from, I think it started with Eric L. Knutson. No one would listen to him, not First Hawaiian Bank, until Mr. Stacy Wong was appointed trustee in 2000. So he agreed with Eric L. Knutson that there was this restriction in the lease. That's where it started.
What about the language being deleted from the earlier, the percentage lease provision that was apparently was in an earlier version and not in the version that was signed by the Seventh-day Adventists? Is there an explanation from your client's point of view for that?
I don't know exactly, Mr. Chief Justice, but I will also note that there was a lot of language that was in earlier drafts of the lease, and the record does indicate that there was a provision that restricted the lease to nonprofit uses, and that language was also taken out. So I don't think that the removal of a percentage rent provision from a draft of the lease really should come into play with the court's interpretation, because I do believe the court's construction of the lease should be limited to the four corners, particularly when both sides have agreed that the lease is unambiguous.
But that agreement on a conclusion of law is not binding on the court. The court determines whether or not a contract is ambiguous and whether parallel law should be considered. Would you agree with that?
Justice McKenna, I absolutely agree.
Let me ask you this. We are here on a motion for summary judgment. It was initially granted in favor of the professor. That was set aside by the ICA, and we are now here. But on MSJ, despite your arguments that, you know, the person representing your client who signed the lease is now old and doesn't really remember what happened, he did testify in his deposition that, yes, I remember that in terms of renting of the cabins, I took it, and he is the signatory representing your client. I took it as we can use it for church members and friends, correct?
That's correct, Mr.
Chairman. All right, so doesn't that in and of itself create a genuine issue of material fact, at least from your perspective, as to whether or not this can be rented to the public?
No, I don't agree, Justice McKenna. I think if you were to conclude in the first instance that the language in paragraph 16 is ambiguous, do we even get to Mr. Arakaki's deposition testimony?
So, actually, under the laws of this state, the court can consider parallel evidence to determine whether or not there is a latent ambiguity, correct? And although Mr. Tom says that he submitted this parallel evidence not for the purpose of showing an ambiguity in the contract, but to show what the remedy should be for what he thinks is a clear contract, isn't then the court bound to consider what the parallel evidence to determine whether or not there is at least a latent ambiguity in the contract?
If the court believes there is a latent ambiguity, then I agree you can consider parole evidence.
It's very interesting because it seems that both of you agree that the contract is totally clear, except both of you have completely divergent views on what it means, right?
That's correct.
Doesn't that even on its face suggest an ambiguity?
I don't believe so, Justice McKenna. I believe that what the case law says is that a dispute over the interpretation of a contract does not in and of itself create an ambiguity. And just because they have come up with an unreasonable interpretation, I don't believe that the court is required to look at parole evidence. And I think if you go back, if you're going to kind of put this in context and you look at the first 17 years of this lease, if you look at what the trustee did for the first 17 years, that speaks to alleged ambiguity more than anything else. So why is the record devoid of any letter from First Hawaiian Bank during the first 17 years saying, stop what you're doing, stop renting to members of the general public? That does not exist. And I would submit, Your Honors, that the reason why that didn't happen is because First Hawaiian Bank knew what was going on. And if I could just read a passage from Mr. Zataki's deposition. This is at the Record on Appeal, Volume 5, 23 to 24. The cabin rentals didn't surprise me because other private schools and other schools have recreational units that they rent out. In my experience, in the parochial school that I went to when I was a child, they had a recreation center that was rented out for additional income. Some local schools have recreational centers that they rent out for additional income. When I went to the University of New York, we had recreational centers in the Adirondacks and on the Hudson River that were rented out for additional incomes to the school and for students because I worked at them. And when my son went to Dartmouth, they have recreational centers and ski slopes in the hotel that they rented out for additional income and to reduce tuition costs. So it didn't shock me that they had these shacks up there that they rented out and got a couple dollars off. That's the trustee.
Well, what about Mr. French's deposition? He apparently signed the lease on behalf of the Eric A. Knudsen Trust. And didn't he say that his understanding was that it was just going to be used for staff housing, dormitories, and not for the public?
I believe he made comments of that nature, Justice McKenna, yes. And
and when your client submitted plans, permitting plans, you did not discuss any plans to rent to the public, correct?
That's incorrect, Justice McKenna.
Okay.
I think that what you're referring to, what they've done is not cited some of the records accurately. There were documents submitted to the Land Use Commission that only dealt with the school.
Okay.
And so in the documents that only dealt with the school, they didn't talk about cabin rentals because it wasn't relevant to the operation of the school.
What relationship does the second sentence, no dwelling shall be constructed or used on the demise premises except for faculty, et cetera, have with respect to the first sentence?
Justice Sokoba, I think the first sentence, which references vacation rentals, vacation residences, deals with temporary stay. The second sentence, using the word dwelling, refers to a permanent residence. And I think this court has to decide what the definition of dwelling is. We've argued that dwelling is a permanent residence. And if you look at the second sentence, it says that it's limited to staff and students. And the only reason that would be limited to staff and students is because it's for permanent housing. So that's why you have a difference in word usage. And I agree with Justice Pollack, who was trying to reconcile sort of a tortured interpretation that the trustee has been using.
But don't you to have the interpretation that you're advancing, you have to say that these vacation cabins are not dwellings. And wouldn't a common sense interpretation of dwelling be a place where people live?
I agree, Chief Justice. A dwelling is a place where people live. I don't believe in this context it's a place where people go and spend the night on vacation and leave and go back to their home. And so that's where I think the difference is between the use of the word dwelling in the second sentence is in the use of the word vacation residence in the first sentence.
So if somebody builds a facility in their backyard and it's just people coming for one or two days, but they come constantly through that, that's not a dwelling, for example, within the sort of common sense application of zoning codes and land use ordinances and other restrictions that might apply in that context?
I would agree with that, Chief Justice. There could be an exception if the house is a dwelling and someone builds a studio. I think the studio would be a dwelling. If you're talking about a playhouse or something like that would be a dwelling.
But I mean, isn't there a reading that the second sentence is a flat out prohibition on dwellings except for a certain limited category of purposes, and the first sentence then is identifies or recognizes there could this one additional category of uses for vacation purposes only for someone who's not covered by the second sentence or category, which is church members, right? Members and staff of the school and church. So church members could go up there for vacation purposes, and that wouldn't violate this otherwise very broad prohibition on the use of dwellings on the premises in the second sentence. That's what I understand their reading to be.
Actually, Chief Justice, their reading has kind of been a work in progress, but one of the things they've argued is that the second sentence restricts the entire use of the property so that the only people who can use the cabins at all are staff members and employees, which makes no sense.
The only people who can live in the cabins are faculty, staff, students, and employees, correct?
Chief Justice, the only people who can use, the language is those dwellings shall be constructed or used. So their argument has been that precludes church members from using the property. And I don't believe that
church members from living in dwellings as opposed to being there on vacation for vacation purposes.
Well, that's our interpretation, but theirs is that church members cannot use the dwellings. Period. They cannot use the cabins. Period. If you follow their interpretation to its logical conclusion, they're saying that the second sentence controls the entire use of the property. And if that's the case, the express language says no dwellings shall be constructed or used. And then it tells you who can use them: faculty, administrative staff, students, and employees. Church members are not listed there. So if you accept their interpretation, the church purchased a cabin rental business and then restricted themselves from using it except for staff and employees. I don't think that that's what the intent of the parties was.
Did anyone raise any issues with whether or not construing vacation residents for members and staff of lessee school and church, which would only allow members of lessee's church to use it, whether that would violate any civil rights issues?
I don't believe that came up, but Justice McKenna, that's actually, it touches on an important point. The council before me in the last matter mentioned that when people have contracts, they don't always go to lawyers in the first instance, and I think that was a problem here. And so you had a bunch of lay people who were giving opinions about the context of the lease after Eric L. Knutson made his "you're cheating the family" comment, and you had members even giving legal opinions.
But then you have people that signed the lease, as Mr. Arakaki and Mr. French, saying that they understood it to be not for the public, right?
Well, Justice McKenna, Mr. Arakaki didn't remember a lot of things. And for example, when he testified.
But this is a summary judgment motion.
So, and I agree, Justice McKenna, if the angle you're taking is that there was a latent ambiguity and you need to look at parole evidence, then that's, I agree, you have to look at all of it. And we have...
And if you look at it, you would concede that there's at least a genuine issue of material fact.
I wouldn't concede that, Justice McKenna. I think if it depends. If you look at the selective comments that they've taken from members 10 or even 15 years after the fact, I don't believe that evidence is relevant. And I think that there might need to be additional...
You're arguing that statements of the signers are not relevant to the interpretation of the intent of the parties?
I'm arguing that the bulk of the parole evidence that they obtained did not involve the signers. They involved, for example, Mr. Imam, who gave a quote, like 2 pages of his deposition testimony, who testified that he read the lease for the first time in 2005 when he was getting ready for his deposition. So, and there are other comments from Mr. Arapaki, for example, when he was asked in his deposition what was meant by friends when he said, I think you referenced part of his testimony, that the cabins could be rented to church members and friends. He was asked, well, what do you consider friends? And he didn't know. He couldn't say. I mean, there's a large portion of his testimony that clearly indicates he wasn't a reliable witness. He cannot provide, I don't think, the court with reliable evidence on the intent of the parties.
That's not the standard on which we need a motion for summary judgment. That's for credibility issues.
Credibility issues would be decided by the trier of fact. I agree, Justice McKenna. So the genuine issues of material fact, I guess that's where I would be focusing on. I don't think that you have a genuine issue because you may have a comment or two by someone that may sound a little ambiguous. If you look at the express language of the lease, I don't believe
Mr. Arapaki was the president of the organization.
Correct.
It's not just someone, correct?
That's correct. And I think if you look at the...
Are you saying then that, you know, the sentence pertaining to dwelling really has nothing to do with the first sentence?
That's correct.
Because you read dwelling to mean something more than temporary stay.
And Justice Sokoba, I think that's correct. And if we use our common sense, when they're talking about staff and students, those are people who are going to be living there. So part of this school is sort of a boarding school where some students do live in dwellings. And the staff members, a lot of the staff members who work there live at the park as well.
You had a count for damage based on wrongful demand. And you asked for damages, money damages for that. And the ICA basically said, well, you didn't follow through on it, so you waived it. And in essence, it's gone. Is that correct?
That is incorrect. You're correct about their ruling, Justice Sokoba, but we have been wrestling with this because, just to back up and talk about the procedural issue, the first appeal was sent back to us because when we issued a final judgment, it was entering an award or a ruling based on summary judgment orders. And the ICA said, no, you need to enter judgment based on specific counts. And what the judge had initially decided was they filed a motion for summary judgment on count 6, arguing that, not that we weren't entitled to damages, but that we needed to have expert testimony to prove damages. So that was the issue. And when the case went back down from the ICA, the circuit court did an amended final judgment. And addressing each count, count 6 was dismissed. It should have said dismissed without prejudice because there was no trial on damages. And if the ICA or this court ruled in our favor and we went back down for trial on damages, then we were going to have a trial on damages. So the ICA, I think, should have maybe ask for oral argument or for the briefing, but the approach that we were going to take was to go back to the circuit court and ask the circuit court to amend the final judgment to correct correct typographical error.
No, I see. I also said that on the first count, you both had moved for summary judgment on the language, and the ICA ruled in your favor, but said you had to go back to prove up your claim. I thought the claim was simply that you, a declaration that you had the right to continue on with renting cabins. Is that correct?
Justice Acoba, that's correct. That's
so correct. What, is there any need, or just, it was based simply on an evaluation of what the language said. So was there any need to send anything back, assuming that the ICA said, no, your interpretation was correct versus the association's interpretation?
I don't believe that it needed to go back because they ruled in our favor on the core issue, and you're
so
correct.
So at that point, you win, right? You get summary judgment, and that should end it. You don't need to go back to the court.
We go back for a determination.
You would want the dismissal of count six to be vacated and to there be a trial on your damages.
Justice McKenna, that's absolutely correct. And we were just unclear procedurally how to deal with it. And because this case has been going on for 10 years, we were trying to take the path of least resistance and do what was procedurally correct. So we thought we had to go back and have the trial court.
But you don't have to go back on count one. That's what I'm saying on your complaint.
Well, we do according to the ICA. We don't.
But assuming count one just resolved on what the correct interpretation of the language should be, there's nothing more to try, right?
Other than damages and...
I'm talking about count one, not count six.
I see.
Far as count one, there's nothing more to be tried.
There's nothing more. There are no other fact issues that need to be
decided. Were no fact issues, in fact, on count one.
There weren't because we pretty much agreed on the basic fact set that the cabins were being rented to the general public. That was a claim they said we...
But evidently the ICO was troubled by the fact that you have different types of cabins. There were sort of tent-like structures and then cabin-like structures. Wasn't that where they were hung up because of this definition of dwelling? Now you're getting into, well, maybe the tent's not a dwelling, but the cabins are, and if that's your premise, which the ICA premise it was, you have to then get into the question of, well, exactly what was it being rented out? Was it the cabins? Was it the tents? Is that why you understand they went the route they did? And wouldn't that be a reason why it would have to go back if you accept your argument that dwelling is a narrower category?
Our Chief Justice, I think that is what they were saying, and based on that, all they did was essentially drop a footnote, and we were trying to kind of figure out exactly where they were coming from. But I think they were trying to determine the difference between dwellings and vacation residences or cabins that were not being used as dwellings.
So a tent-like structure, not a dwelling for you, correct?
Not a tent-like structure.
Okay.
I don't believe
how about a cabin with walls and a ceiling, but it's only used one or two days at a time? Dwelling or not?
Depends on who's living there.
So, well, I said one or two days at a time.
Oh, that would be a vacation residence.
Not a dwelling.
Not a dwelling.
But the ICA seemed to think that might be a dwelling because at some point it's got a roof, it's got walls, it's got, you know, TV, water, sink, stove, whatever. At some point it starts to look like a dwelling even if people are only there for a day or two at a time, right?
I agree, Chief Justice. But, you know, that's only relevant if there is an issue regarding whether we're using dwellings or vacation residences and whether there's some kind of monetary...
Does the record show which were being rented out during this period of time? Was it the tents, the dwellings, or both? It was both, right?
No, I think that there is something...
The tents, the cabins are both, pardon.
Right. I think that in the record there may be a discussion of which cabins are being used as vacation residences versus dwellings. I'm not sure that that's relevant to count one, though. I don't think to determine whether or not the church can rent cabins to the general public, whether or not there has to be a determination of which is which. Because the ICA gave us the guidance we needed on count one, which is we can rent cabins to whomever we want for vacation rental purposes and the other permitted uses in the first sentence. And secondly, that the dwellings are permanent residences for staff and employees. So I don't think that going back to the circuit court on count one regarding deciding exactly which one of these are dwellings and which ones are not is really necessary for count one.
It seems kind of ironic, but here the, I guess the lessor is saying, look, you should have restricted use. But didn't the lessor ask for a five-year business plan in order to generate more income so that would benefit both you, I assume, and the lessor? And am I incorrect?
You're absolutely correct, Justice.
And so when they didn't like your business plan, that's when they started trying to enforce the lease and to terminate it? Or
that's correct. That's correct. So the first thing out of the gate was not stop what you're doing. And
so should we consider that parallel events?
I don't think so, Justice McKenna. Because Mr. Tom brought it up, though, he's questioning for the first time in these proceedings from start to finish that there was a time to cure of an alleged breach. And that's just simple.
But it goes to equity, right? I mean, there's a lot of talk in this case about equity. So
I don't think, Justice Sokova, that you get to equity because we're dealing with a contract, and the contract has specific terms, and there's a notice and cure provision. So,
and you would agree that the cardinal rule of contract interpretation is to try to enforce the intent of the parties.
I agree.
And in terms of the inclusive language, including, that is a rule of statutory construction in general, correct?
Well, it's a rule of contract interpretation, and you know,
which white case says that that's a rule of contract interpretation?
Well, I guess I was saying that, Justice McKenna, because if you look at Leilai Montefal, that's one of the cases that defines the word including. They use the definition from Black's Law Dictionary, so it's not like they were interpreting a criminal statute. And in the
was that the wrongful death statute? No.
It might have been. I'm not sure.
They were construing the wrongful death statute.
Yes, but they were interpreting a word using Black's Law Dictionary, and I think in the two pages or so of citations that I gave the court, I researched this issue.
But if you use the ordinary reading of the term including, whether it's used in a statute, a contract, or a lease, I mean, it has basically essentially one meaning, right?
One of
that's something more than what's previously described is added to what was previously described.
That's correct. It means including but not limited to. That's the definition of that word. And I was not able to.
That's not a latent ambiguity, is it?
I don't believe it is, Justice Sokova.
What is a latent ambiguity?
It would be something that's not apparent to the parties upon the first reading of the document. And I think if you read a paragraph and it's clear to you when you read it, I don't think you address any issues of latent ambiguity. And I think that's what you're dealing with here. If you take this lease, if you look at this use provision, you read it, and you apply the commonly understood definition of the word including and the commonly understood definitions of the word dwelling, you get to one result. And on the issue of including, the U.S. Supreme Court, federal courts, state courts, I have not found a single case anywhere in the country that has said the word including is one of limitation instead of expansion. So I think it would be unprecedented for this court to rule that the word including is one of limitation. And I see my time is almost up. I wanted to close with brief comments from the motion to expedite the appeal that we filed back in September 22nd, 2010.
Counsel, your time ran, but I'll give you have a minute or two just to wrap up now, so very quickly.
Thank you, Chief Justice. This is a quote. 3 years ago, the church highlighted the importance of the court's decision in its opening brief. The dispositive issue before the court in this appeal is the definition of the word including in a lease and whether that word is one of expansion or limitation. All other issues flow from this word and the circuit court's misinterpretation of this word, although it is impossible to determine precisely how the circuit court construed this word because the circuit court failed and refused to explain its ruling. The importance of this court's holding cannot be understated. The continued viability of a K-12 school is at stake. The circuit court's ruling has crippled the church's ability to generate income to support the Healy Adventist School and could lead to the loss of the property at issue and the relocation and or closure of the school. The school is suffering. Enrollment is down. The Healy Mountain Park revenue has been significantly slashed as a result of this dispute. A ruling from this court, however the court rules, is critical to the school's existence and future planning. So what I would ask the court to do is
I just have, I'm sorry.
No, well, of course.
If that parenthetical was gone, including vacation residence for members and staff of LSE school and church, assuming that that did not exist, and all it says was used only for educational, recreation, agriculture, et cetera, would recreation include vacation rentals to the public?
I think it would, because you still have to define the word dwelling, which is permanent residence, and so whatever other cabins that are not dwellings could be used for any of the other permitted uses.
Thank you very much, Mr. Valencia. Now we'll hear from Mr. Tom in your rebuttal. Let's ask there, actually, Mr. Tom, I have a question for you. Mr. Valencia argued that it's, or suggested that it was the church's position, I'm sorry, that it was the trustee's position that church members would not be allowed to use the cabins on this site. Is or is that not the trustee's position?
That is not the trustee's position. They can use it for their staff, and they are using it for their staff. They can use it for their students, and they are using it for their students. The only prohibition is renting these cabins to the public.
Let me, could you answer the last question I asked Mr. Valencia? If that parenthetical was gone, and the parenthetical where it says including vacation residence and so on, and it just said used only for educational, recreation, agriculture, healthcare, etc., would vacation residences for the public be allowed?
No.
Wouldn't it have been quite simple to simply say in the lease that these uses are limited to church members or staff, rather than to carve out vacation residences for staff and for members of the church, than to say that dwellings should go to, I guess, staff and leave out members, etc. But so if you do something like that, wouldn't anyone reading it have to give effect to what's stated there? In other words, there's no limitation on the first sentence. There's a provision that ensures that members and members of the church and members of the staff can use the property as vacation residence, sort of indicating that people who are not members of the staff, et cetera, can also use the property.
Well, I wasn't there back in 1983.
No, none of us were. That's my point, that when you write something into a legal document, then we should, as a court and other parties, should be able to look at that language and interpret that based on its ordinary meaning. And its ordinary meaning places no restriction on the uses.
I think the parenthetical is a definitional term. It is not restrictive and it's not expansive.
If we take also the ordinary meaning of dwelling, I mean, that connotes, I think, to most people, a place where you have a more or less permanent abode, right? It's not a place that you visit now and then, et cetera. So it would it be an unreasonable reading to look at dwelling as a place where people more or less live on a more or less permanent basis?
No, we think the term dwelling is much broader as it's used within the lease. As an example, is a hotel with transient rentals.
Why make a differentiation between vacation residence and dwelling? Why not just use the term dwelling? Then you cover vacation residence. But if you make that distinction, shouldn't anyone reading that contract take that seriously, that you made a differentiation between dwellings and vacation residence?
I think the court needs to look at paragraph 16 in context. I think it needs to look at it in context with paragraph 1.1b.
I know, but 1.1b only says it's restricted to the uses, and you go to 16 and then it lists the uses. It doesn't say anything about who can participate in the uses.
Well, it doesn't say you can rent the cabins to the general public. Had that been the intent, then unfortunate thing is here we are, what, 30, 40 years after the fact, trying to interpret what the parties intended. And since I have a little bit of time, let me, just for the record, note that the first indication internally at the association that there were questions about whether the cabin rentals were warranted under the lease is in 1992. And there is an audit done of the park. This is in the record at volume 6, starting at page 459. And the auditor says, quote, "The problem of the park needing the most immediate attention is to have their leasehold carefully reviewed by the conference and their lawyer to determine if the park rentals and the school are in compliance with the agreement." Parole evidence. But contrary to what Mr. Valencia said, it wasn't 14 years after the lease was entered into that this surfaced internally within the association.
You said that was 1992?
1992, that's correct. And then in 1996, in 1999, in 2000, and 2001, there are all these internal discussions within the church as to whether what they're doing by renting to the public violates their core principles.
And during this time, we were still renting to the public.
Correct.
And neither the trustee from the bank or, I guess, whoever was the trustee, stopped that.
Mr. Eric Knudsen was complaining about it.
Okay.
And I won't get into the history of what happened with First Line Bank and the beneficiaries.
Are there any further questions for Mr. Tom? Very well. Thank you, counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement.